You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this panel, and thank you for coming. I'm Sandrine Rastello. I'm a reporter with Bloomberg. I cover global economics here in Washington, and I'm soon moving to Mumbai, India. And I think infrastructure is a good thing that's relevant to both what international financial institutions as well as India, which has a big need and is trying to boost up the volume. Today we have a great panel, a very diverse panel to discuss this topic, which couldn't be more timely. We have the IMF calling for more infrastructure financing. We have Larry Summers following up with the op-ed in the Financial Times. And tomorrow the World Bank is going to sign its new global infrastructure facility. And of course, it's also going to be a discussion topic of the G20 meeting this week. So we've had this multiplication of interventions, of declaration about infrastructure financing, talks of huge numbers for the financing gap. Yet, for us journalists covering it, and maybe for some of you, it's not always very clear if there's cooperation, if there's coordination between all these announcements, what the private sector is expected to do, what the public sector is expected to do. And that's why today we have a great panel to discuss these topics. We have, so first I'm going to start to my right. We have Michelle Wormser. I'm doing the American pronunciation. Michelle is a veteran of the World Bank. Most recently, until 2 weeks ago, he worked at MIGA, the political risk agency, a branch of the World Bank, and he's had a very long career focused on Africa at some point also. I think he can bring us a good perspective on what a multilateral can do and the guarantee that the investors may be looking for. Next to him, we have a government official who's going to give us the perspective of the client, so to speak. So, Cabinet Secretary of Kenya, the Finance Secretary, Mr. Henry Rotich. And we hope to hear from you concrete examples of how it's been like to deal with, on the one hand, maybe multilateral agencies such as the World Bank, and perhaps you also have more experience with countries like China that we've heard a lot about. What are the pros and cons of each? Speaking of private sector, to your right, we have Julia Frescat from Meridiam, which is a company that goes from the conception to the management of infrastructure projects. What does the private sector want? What is it looking for? What is it that countries are not providing? We hope to hear more from that. To her right, that I can see there, Henrik Bergloff, also representing a development bank, the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development. He's the chief economist and special advisor to the president. He's also a specialist of countries in transition and has a lot of experience working jointly with the private sector. So it will be interesting to hear what he has to say. Next to him, Amadou Sy, here from Brookings, from the Africa Growth Initiative. And maybe you can give us some Africa-wide perspective on this topic. So each participant is expected to do a short 7 minute or so presentation. And so I don't know if there's a special order, but did you want to give your perspective, Michel?
Well, with pleasure, and thank you very much for. It's true that I'm brand new from the World Bank Group since I left 2 weeks ago, so I'm just getting used to the new vacation. And it's very nice to interrupt these vacations to come here. But to tell you one thought I have about the multilaterals and about the development at the end of my 36-year career. The time when organizations like the World Bank were financing infrastructure should really be over. It's not anymore about financing of infrastructure, because in many ways the amounts that could be provided by overseas development assistance are very small compared to the needs. And and because of the fiscal constraints that developed countries have, you cannot expect that in the next 10 years there is going to be a huge increase in these amounts. So what the World Bank and other such agencies need to do is to help the private sector get into the space of infrastructure. These huge amounts which are there, the pension funds, the mirage of these big amounts and the difficulty to mobilize them into infrastructure, this is the biggest challenge that is faced by these multilateral development agencies. And I would suggest that there are four avenues where the multilaterals can help. First, sector reforms. Unless we have sectors which are balanced and sustainable, unless we have policies which are predictable, unless we have institutions for maintenance of the assets, nobody in their right mind are going to put private money in infrastructure in the countries which are not their own. So if we want to have more flows from capital markets into infrastructure, the role that MDBs have to play is to use their global expertise, really, into the implementation of reform to help these countries move from dysfunctional sectors to sectors which can have a chance of attracting private finance. Second is projects which can really be transformational. The example projects, I was discussing just coming in, the Kenya example, where Kenya is actually a good case because there has been now a series of IPPs which have attracted private financing. And it shows that once you work with a government on a first structure which is attractive to the private sector, others will come. It takes a long time. In Nigeria, we've taken close to 3 years to get to the closing of Azura project. But it is with that closing that then you unleash a whole sector. Third is political risk mitigation. Agencies like the World Bank have a unique place because they have a strong relations with governments. So organizations like the one I come from, which is MIGA, has a history of mobilizing $30 billion of financing towards private projects. And in the whole history of MIGA, 750 transactions, there were only two claims for political risk, one in Indonesia, one in Argentina. It's not that there were not ever any problems, but because of the stature and the position of the World Bank, we were able to diffuse the risk. So the partnership between organizations which mitigate the risk and the private pension funds and others can be a critical part in allowing them to go into places which are still reforming and which are still risky. And the final point I would put is the idea that the balance sheets of these organizations, and that's probably a theme for the G20, have to be used much more dynamically. The time when we used $1 of AIDA to have $1 off road should really be the exception. What we should do is to go for trenching of risk. What we should go about is to subsidize, to finance the subsidy part and get the private sector to come in for the rest in the PPP, which we have done, for example, for the third bridge of Abidjan in Côte d'Ivoire. These are the cases that we have to do. So it has to be all about leverage, about trenching of risk, and about mobilization. And the guarantees of these organizations, instead of being the smallest part of these organizations, have to become the biggest part. $1 of MIGA is leveraging $24 of investments. This is very different from $1 of AIDA leveraging $1 of investments. So we have to put these organizations on their head and make the leveraging of their capital to the maximum impact the key objective of where the G20 is going in terms of getting the capital market, pension funds and others to go into the space where so far they have done only reluctantly. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. In time. Now let's move to the experience of a government. And Secretary, that would be great to hear what it's been in your case in Kenya.
Thank you. Yeah, let me start by saying that obviously the role of infrastructure economies are very, very important. In Africa, it's now estimated that the infrastructure deficit is of $100 billion, of which about 82% of that is just financed through local and foreign sources. In Kenya, our infrastructure deficit is of $2 billion annually. And there's no doubt that improvement in infrastructure will help a lot in increasing growth and human development. Now, we have prioritized in Kenya infrastructure to be the main drivers for growth and also to unlock the weak competitiveness that we have in the country. At the moment, we have many infrastructure programs that we are implementing. This runs from about 10 years ago. The government has put a lot of emphasis. Currently, we are targeting energy to be the key sector. And at the moment, we've planned to put about 500 megawatts of power within a period of 3 years. This is a very tall order, as you know. Financing that is quite a huge challenge. We also are thinking of, actually, we have already implemented a railway project, which is a standard gauge rail from running from Mombasa to across the neighboring countries. Again, it's a huge requirement. It is costing about $4 billion. We have a number of projects in the ports and also both the sea and the airports. A lot of, again, requiring huge resources. The road sector also requires huge resources. So all these we have prioritized, but obviously funding them has been the big challenge. And I believe the discussion today really is to look at what are the other alternative ways of funding. So let me start with the usual traditional ways that we have been funding infrastructure. As all you know, we have been funding this through our revenue sources, the domestic revenues that we have mobilized. Obviously, this is not enough. Most of our countries in Africa just raises around 16 to 18% of GDP from revenue. In Kenya, we have been raising almost about 20% plus. But this is not enough given our all socio-economic needs. But with the importance of infrastructure, we've also gone ahead to borrow to finance this infrastructure. Fortunately, in Kenya, we have a deep domestic market, also reformed our pension, and which has actually provided a huge pool of resources. But again, we cannot rely heavily from the domestic sources borrowing. We have also gone to an extent of issuing infrastructure bonds at the local market, which has gone a long way to finance some of this infrastructure that I've talked about. The development partners has also played a key role. The World Bank, African Development Bank, all these development financial institutions have been a key player. But obviously also their funding sources is diminishing. We know that the resources from that is no longer forthcoming than before. Of course, we are also asking them to see if they can open other windows. For example, in the World Bank, we have been relying on IDA, but we are also looking at accessing IBRD windows. I think some of the countries are eligible to access those other financing at a more, of course, commercial rates, but at least still very reasonable. The African Development Bank also opening up the ADB window, which again we are trying to access to fill this infrastructure gap. But bilateral loans has also been very important, and of late China has come up as a key player, and the China Exim Bank has put a lot of resources in Africa. In the current round of financing, they have committed about $20 billion for Africa. Kenya alone, because of the standard gauge rail that we have borrowed from Exim Bank, is taking only 20% of that, you can imagine. And you still have about other 50 countries that are competing for that resource from China. So again, it is also becoming a constraint. So now we are thinking of other sources. The private sector is also coming on board. We have developed a PPP framework in Kenya, which has become a very important framework, which we are engaging the private sector. We have a list of about 60 projects now, which we have assessed, and we think the private sector can actually invest in that in partnership with government. Let me also say the role of the MIGA, which has just been mentioned here. MIGA has played a big role in guaranteeing some of the investments, particularly in the energy sector in Kenya. And they have played a big role by bringing direct investors, especially independent power producers in Kenya. So I think leveraging on the work of MIGA, we expect to fill a lot of infrastructure gap by ensuring that the partial risk guarantees that are provided draws in a number of private investment in the country. We have also gone the extent of accessing international capital markets. We issued a sovereign bond about three months ago. This again has gone away, a long way to fill the gaps that we have just mentioned. So, quite of innovative ways we are trying to, of course, really work with the private sector by all means. There is also, I want to emphasize the importance of really preparing the projects to attract private investment. I know an example of a project in Kenya which we had a sort of a myriad of investors, particularly combining equity, debt, and other sources. And this is the project, the biggest wind power project in Africa, Lake Turkana Wind Power, going to produce 300 megawatts. And it is the structuring of that project that really brought in a lot of private sector into it. So the very important thing really is to prepare these projects well to attract private investors into it. So I think let me stop now.
Thank you for this.
Thank you.
It's a perfect transition since we're going into Julia. For the private sector, maybe you'll let us know during your presentation if preparation is something you see as key and you see not enough of in where you invest.
Absolutely, and I couldn't echo more the words that I've just heard on my left. I mean, perhaps I ought to just clarify at the outset that we're not, Meridiam is not a company, it's actually an investment fund. And we are in OECD a 25-year maturity investment fund that invests really from development, from the start of construction, right the way through to the end of operations. So we are long-term private, but also long-term patient capital. And we have just launched a similar fund for Africa with a 15-year maturity, looking again at that whole sphere right the way through from development to operations. So I suppose we're quite a good example of one of the points that's already been made, which is that there's an awful lot of financing out there. I mean, when we look at the marketplace at the moment, there are it's a wash. I mean, apart from the finance, obviously, you've raised the projects in Kenya, that are all over the world. If you come up with a good investable project, the competition is intense. The margins are going down and to sort of pre-great financial crisis levels. The structures are becoming more and more light. So financing, great. It's wonderful. There's an awful lot of it out there. So why isn't it going into the whole of your 60 projects that you have got in Kenya at the moment? And why isn't it going into that huge infrastructure gap that we see around the world? And I think it's a lot to do not so much with finance, but with funding. And I think it's the structure of funding within governments that make projects investable that is the absolute critical linkage. And it's something that, as the private sector should be working hard to make sure that that linkage can come about. Now, there are various ways in which this can be done. And I think it's both by way of sharing knowledge and experience with the public sector, having a very good dialogue. And for that reason, I do welcome the new Knowledge and Collaboration Centre that's being proposed at the moment by the G20. I think that the actual details are a little unclear, and goodness knows what it's finally going to look like. But the fact that it is out there in the market as a proposition is extremely good. And similar types of propositions are being proposed elsewhere. So it's very important to have that level of communication between the public and the private sector, because we in the private sector must not forget this is our problem as much as it is government's problem in delivering infrastructure. There are, for example, in Europe, there are 13 trillion of savings that have been collected by pension funds and by insurance companies. And how on earth, unless good infrastructure can be realised, are those returns going to be made to the pensioners of the future unless we have a greater circulation money. So communication is a very good start. The second area, which Michelle referred to, is the concept of how in the more fragile countries, if I put it like that, are we going to make sure that there's a good linkage in between public and private? And I think that's where the development banks can actually come up with very effective responses. We talked about leverage, and I think it's very important to focus on where that leverage can go. In certain countries, and not the case again, but in certain countries, there are very limited local markets in terms of long-term financing. Perhaps development banks could look at providing support or guarantee for both the currency issues, but also in the longer term as well, those maturity issues, so that you begin to get the reserve of local patient capital so that it doesn't have to all be imported and then countries face to currency risks over time. I think the other area that we've certainly seen is co-investment, and that's one of the issues that can also develop the whole knowledge and structuring arrangements. And there's another thing that I'd like to mention is innovation. We've heard of excellent innovations already today, but there are there are great innovations here in the US in both the private activity bonds and also with TIFIA and making tax-efficient approaches toward infrastructure that, again, are going to generate more projects going down the line. I'd probably finish by saying that there are certain words by the new president of the European Commission that I like to paraphrase, which is, we know where the projects are, we just don't know how to develop them all yet.
Thank you. And now moving on to Eric. If I know you have a presentation.
It's fine. I can handle it without, I was told that it would be a presentation. Anyhow.
No safety net. Okay.
Thank you very much, and thank you for inviting me, and it's very nice to be back at Brookings, where I've had many pleasant memories from my time here. So I come from the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, and we work primarily in emerging Europe and in North Africa, and we work primarily with exactly the issue of how to bring in the private sector into infrastructure investments, and we do that, you know, both through debt and equity, and we do it through indirect instrument using local banks. We work with Meridium as well, we have a joint fund together. We do it using commercial pricing, but try to have longer tenors that more correspond to asset life. We do a lot of technical assistance to help prepare and implement the project. And the point I want to make, and it's sort of been made in different varieties so far, is that finance is not really the issue. There is a lot of capital out there. The problem is elsewhere, but obviously there is also a need to mobilize that finance, and I come back to a few initiatives that we have been involved in that we are very excited about. So the problems are at the project structuring and project implementation, and very much policy risk associated with that. So it's both sort of governance issues, but also policy risk. And this is not only in developing and emerging economies, also very much, particularly in the energy sector now in advanced markets, there's a lot of policy uncertainty, certainly in Europe at the moment. The other problem is, of course, the funding problem. Where do you get the money? You know, how do you raise the money? Do you use it for user fees, or do you use it for taxpayers? And it sounds like, you know, Kenya is doing some good work trying to help develop that. Certainly something that we try to also think a lot about when we are part of investing. So let me go through a little bit these different elements and see where I think one can do things. If you look at the planning and the sort of project implementation, obviously it's about, you know, these are very complex projects. They require, and we all try to promote, you know, market-based solutions. And, you know, that's not always feasible, and particularly in where you start, this may not be possible. What we're trying to develop is sort of a trajectory towards a more market-based solutions and with, you know, private capital coming in. And of course, in some dream world, there are these PPPs, which we know are very difficult to get to work. And you know, we have been involved in quite a few of them. And when we go back and look at them, it's a very mixed record. It's very complex. It's very often very asymmetric relationships. They're frequently renegotiated, very complex structures to both structure from the beginning, to, but also then to implement, and dealing with, again, with this issue of policy risk is very real. And of course, when you get into other areas of climate change adaptation or climate change mitigation, you have additional layers of complexity, very difficult for local governments, and we work a lot with municipalities. They are very inexperienced, often dealing with very sophisticated international operators. Our role we see typically as being, you know, helping the local partner try to get a more sustainable arrangement, and not creating structures that will then go through, you know, political turbulence and will eventually renegotiate it. So it's really very much to try to balance these relationships we see as a very important role for us. We want to I'll say a few words about two things that specific initiatives that we are involved in. One has to do with the preparation of projects. So we think that this is a very serious issue. It's sort of a market failure. It's also a governance failure. We are putting up now what we call an infrastructure project preparation facility, where we'll put up 40 million euros as a beginning for the initial operation. There are going to be two windows, one for public sector and for private sector window for PPPs. It's going to be about strong emphasis on policy dialogue, getting the policy right, getting sustainable policy arrangement, project preparation, also support to project implementation. We are now trying to raise donor funding for this, but we'll also use some of our own funds for this. I think this is, for us, a very high priority. The other thing we are doing, which goes back to this issue that there is a lot of long-term capital out there, but it doesn't go to the right places. As you know, the IFC has done, it's created this asset management company that co-invests with IFC in projects. We have chosen a slightly different route, but with the same objective, bringing in long-term investors, pension funds, sovereign wealth funds. We are creating a structure that synthetically replicates our equity portfolio. So on every future investment that we are making in the equity space, there are some restrictions, but we will allow these, we'll bring in these institutional investors. So there's no cherry picking. They have to buy into our governance arrangements, our mandate, and so on. And that's, we're right now in the middle of raising funds for this new what we call equity partnership facility, and it's something that we are very excited about. It's also been a very interesting experience for us, because it really forced us to raise our game in the equity space. Maybe as a very last word on coming back to this policy risk, because I think it is important to say that this, to me, is the number one issue, and again, it's not only developing and emerging markets. And there are a lot of things that IFIs can do that I think are important to help deal with this. We can, and it was also already mentioned, absorb maybe some more risk ourselves. My view of that is that it's actually quite limited what we can do. And we've certainly seen in the crisis how, you know, rating agencies have been hovering over the IFIs, and a number of IFIs have been downgraded and had to do things. We all got capital increases to deal with those issues. I think the space there is quite limited. Some things can be done, but it's not that much. We can do a lot on project structure, project implementation. We can, as we said, use the fact that we have these multilateral governance structures where the recipient countries are shareholders that can help. We can also develop capacity for dealing with project preparation and project implementation. We can also be part of shaping the sector context, because, for example, if you're dealing with equity, with infrastructure in the energy space, energy policies are absolutely critical. We can be part of shaping that. And then finally, I think by immobilizing institutional capital, by creating a more sustainable financing arrangements, we can also help incentivize local governments to have more consistent policies over time. That's what I wanted to add. Thank you.
And I do to conclude.
Yes, thank you. So there's a quote I like from a Scandinavian university that says, we are as confused as ever, but on more important things and not at a higher level. Yeah. So there's definitely a consensus that these days that infrastructure, more infrastructure is good for growth, is good for development, is even good for future generations. You know, we've all seen Larry Summers' op-ed and WIO chapter and so on. From an African perspective, we've had for a long time a lot of efforts into this transformation narrative and the importance of infrastructure. So, and the one angle we would like to take here is that there's a big focus on this supply and demand of finance, that there's a lot of long-term money out there, but it's not trickling to these long-term projects. But sometimes we worry that, you know, this focus on the private sector is can be problematic. And in the words of my colleague Jeff Goodman here, the question is, are we creating orphans? So if you look at data from the World Bank PPIF, in 2012, about $90 billion went into Africa, including North Africa infrastructure. About 47% was financed by government raising their own revenues, as the cabinet secretary said, and about 53% were external. Out of this 53%, only 10% came from the private sector. So 10% of about like 9 billion. So out of 90 billion of infrastructure finance to Africa, only 9 billion came from the private sector. So of course, there's a potential to increase the private sector. We've all seen the limits from the public sector, the limits from the government raising finance. So I think there's no problem there. But the problem is, you know, are we getting distracted about the domestic agenda to raise fiscal revenues? Are we getting distracted from the domestic agenda to develop capital markets? So Kenya is maybe an exception. It has this pension fund and so on. But you take, let's say, the DRC, definitely we are a long way into developing the local capital markets and the local long-term savings there. Another one is that private money sometimes, and it depends, of course, if you long-term patient money, but sometimes facing these constraints of having quarterly returns to show, private sector money just can go into take the path of least resistance. So you're going, where does private sector money goes into Africa? We've seen the success of in the information technology and communication sector, mobile phone. It was all private sector money really led in Africa. Concessions, that private sector money would go. But how about the other sectors, where it's more difficult to ring fence the cash flows, right? Let's take in agriculture, for example, infrastructure in agriculture. That's going to be more difficult for the private sector to go there. And then interest, and even transportation sometimes. So interestingly, China is filling in the gap there. And, if you look at the external money coming into Africa, China is having a big push. We've heard the numbers, say, for the railway project, which is a regional project. But also, going into this theme of are we creating orphans,
How about urbanization and municipal urban infrastructure? So Africa is urbanizing at a very, very rapid rate, maybe one of the fastest rate in the world. But we know that our municipalities in Africa don't have much revenues, fiscal revenues, but yet the demand, the pressure is coming there very interestingly. And is the private sector going to address that, or should we really rethink about, you know, put everything in perspective and see, okay, let's also keep in mind that we need to finance urban infrastructure. So basically, and it's just to come back to the theme, I think it would be good at some point to take a step back, look at the whole portfolio of sources of financing that we are getting. Of course, important to increase the private sector because that's really where the potential is, but not lose perspective of the other parts of this puzzle and the other parts of this agenda, and bringing it back again, you know. So, for example, Danny Roderick and Margaret Macmillan had this paper about the African miracle, and you know, everybody's asking, okay, we've had this very, very high growth rate. Is it sustainable? How can Africa sustain that? And then we see that we haven't followed the growth model that we've seen in Asia, where labor has moved from agriculture to manufacturing and exporting, right? Our labor is moving more to a service sector, right? So how is in terms of prioritization, how are we prioritizing so that we are financing the infrastructure that we need for our transformation that will help us have this sustainable long-term growth rates? For example, agriculture, infrastructure in agriculture is not really coming from the private sector, and it's needed, right? That's a bit the idea.
Thank you. And we have time for both questions. I'm going to ask the panel, and there will be time for questions in the room. I'd like to go back to this notion of orphans or sectors that maybe the private sector is less interested in. And maybe I'd like to direct my question to Julia and to the secretary. Julia, is there any sector you won't go into? Do you leave orphans?
Oh, I hope we don't leave orphans anywhere. When I was listening to that, I was thinking that of really the spectrum of risk and investment that the private sector tends to look at when it's looking at what really will the places to put its money. And clearly, from the point of view of the telecom side of things, this is a sector that is really inexpensive to create. Once you've done the first sort of set of masts and handsets, etc., you've got a ready set of income coming directly from it. And it can all be done quite quickly. And then as you go down the development line, once you're into, I think, energy, you know, some of the renewables projects can happen quite quickly. You know, gas-fired will take slightly longer. Hydro will take slightly longer. Railways will take even longer. And therefore, you need to look at where the private sector is most efficient in placing its funding. And I would argue that it is in those shorter term projects of realization, because the most expensive and the most risky money from the point of view of the private sector is actually the development money, because you are essentially putting money, and the average project development period can be between 5 and 7 years. So you can be putting private sector money at risk, which is very expensive, and expensive not just in terms of us. The people who fund us or provide support for us are pension funds and insurance companies, and they need money that goes back to their pensioners. So I'm not saying it's money that we as the private sector are looking at as solely as high risk. It's actually also the people behind us. And so when we look at investments, we will probably look at projects that are in a more realizable space than the ones that are longer term, and the projects that have the potential for having both private and public sector engagement going forward. Going back to what I was saying about funding is really comes from two places. It either comes from the user, either the picker up of the telephone or the driver down the road, or it comes from a tax base. And it is actually when we can see that there is the potential of a mixture of user and tax base, which is going to take up, which is actually going to build in growth that is going to be realized in a longer stage, an earlier stage, in a project that has got a reasonably shorter development period, that that is the sector we go into. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we exclude or include particular areas. It's more looking at a spectrum of risk. So a rather long answer to your question.
Secretary, did you notice, or what is your experience, are there some sectors you've had more trouble finding investors for? And is that where bilateral countries like China step in, or what's your experience? Yeah.
I think, I would agree. Out of our 60 projects, for example, that we have, I think it covers entirely almost every sector. We have projects in the energy, we have projects in the rail, we have projects in even in the health sector, where you might not imagine private sector would venture, but they are even in education. So we have, you know, projects across all sectors. I think the important thing is to, you know, make those projects viable for private sector to come in. And I think where government can work with private sector is to fill, do some viability gap analysis where government can play a role so that it can catalyze the private sector come in. For example, in the upset project, which is one of our corridors we want to open, we know it might be difficult for private sector to invest. It's a very huge project, but by government starting off by doing one or two baths in the port, draws in private sector to come in. Also in the health and housing sector, which is an area where, you know, might not attract private sector, but where government can come in and, you know, fill the viability, you know, gap there by maybe putting in some money and then bringing in the private sector. I think it does work. So we've seen interest across the board. Even in the urban areas, the urban commuter rail, where we have a lot of, you know, interest to develop, we've seen a lot of private sector. Very. I think the point is really to structure this project and prepare them very well, such that, you know, funding can actually come. And I agree on the point of also, you know, tying this to sort of a dedicated levy. We've seen this work very well even in our standard gauge rail. In Kenya, we had to come up with a railway development levy, which actually would fill the gap, because the project alone may not actually generate revenue streams to pay for the investment by the private sector. But by dedicating some certain, levy or tax on that, it does help bring in private sector. So I think I agree with, you know, or even some things like off-take agreements, which it has worked in the energy sector, where you guarantee that you will off-take the power, and that has actually brought in private sector. So it's possible to engage.
And I see that Eric had a point to make.
No, just two points that relates to this discussion, because I agree very much that that there is a risk that private sector will leave certain parts out. But and there are, of course, some sensitivities in engaging private sector in some parts of this space. But healthcare is one area, and it was mentioned as a sensitive area. What we see is, of course, that these health sectors in the countries where we operate have been privatized effectively, even though the government is everywhere. The problem is that because of bad governance, because of corruption, you have effectively private systems that are working in a very inefficient and very distorted way. So, but we don't do very much in healthcare. But I think the fact that private sector there are sensitivities there should be recognized, but we also have to see how the world really functions in reality. I was going to make another point on again, the private sector is not everything, but what I think is important is to get even for example, municipal infrastructure, get private sector principles to separate the finances of utilities and local municipalities and separate them from the Ministry of Finance and so on. These are just to get transparency, get more efficient ways. It doesn't necessarily require private sector finance. For example, now we have recently gone into Egypt. Of course, we are very far away, I think, from major private sector participation in utilities there, but we can still start preparing, for example, water utilities for more efficient ways of managing and making sure that these distortions that are there right now we can try to address, and maybe sometime in the far future there is a way for them to also raise private money. But it's the principles of private sector that are important too, and the management skills and ability to structure and implement projects that we want to bring.
I know you wanted to say something, Michel, too, but I was wondering, as an observer, as a journalist, we see all these announcements, and I'm wondering, perhaps Michel or perhaps Eric, you want to answer this. Are we just seeing a lot of announcements? How much cooperation is there between the BRICS Bank, which doesn't exist yet, but
there's not much cooperation with them.
the different initiatives that have been announced, the different windows, ABRD just announced a window. The World Bank has now this platform that we're not exactly sure it's going to do. It's going to be more knowledge than money. Is there? And I understand that you said preparation is very important. You want to make the project bankable. Are we going too much towards preparation and not enough funding, or is it, you think, the appropriate direction that's being taken? If you want to answer this one.
Well, first, I think that the fact that there are so many initiatives at the same time are just an evidence of how much frustration there is around the issue of trying to get a lot of funding go to the infrastructure, because infrastructure is so important for growth and for the growth that delivers difference for the citizens. But I would the GIF is a very interesting idea, because the idea that with better structuring, which I think a number of people have said today, we could get more private financing into places where otherwise they would hesitate to put capital, because not everyone is as patient as Julie is, is, I think, a very good idea. And what I have found is that with very solid structuring, you get projects done, including in Africa, where otherwise they would have been done in the public sector. And if you allow me, I would just say one, I would say to Amadou that I disagree with him about the orphans. I think there are orphans, but there are much less orphans than what we have today. And thinking, oh, well, the private sector will come, but there is so much that can be done by the private sector, why don't we concentrate in raising more public financing, because the solution will be there, I think he's missing the point of the scope that the private sector could take in a number of places. And I'll just mention a couple of them. Even generation, people say IPPs are possible. But the number of countries that I've seen in Africa, for example, where by lack of planning, they come to the point where they have to do an emergency project, and where the emergency project has to be done in the public sector, because otherwise it would take too long to prepare it. Look at Agreco's numbers of projects that you see in Africa, which are very expensive. How many of those could have been done as IPPs if it had been planned earlier at a cheaper cost? Transmission lines. People say these are orphans, but they don't have to be orphans. Right now, Mozambique is planning, or at least had been thinking, about doing a tolling arrangement for some transmission lines. Transport, which previously was a sector where nobody was going, because it was seen as a normal place for the public sector to go. Look at what's happening in Senegal right now, and the highway between Dakar and Diamniadio, which has been done in the private sector. Look at Abidjan, doing the third bridge of Abidjan in the private sector. Look at Nigeria, doing its Niger bridge in the private sector. So there is no obligation to think of public sector for transport. And the final point I would say is that people say, okay, but the rural space has to be public. And it doesn't have to be. I have seen a lot of water concessions that were in the private sector, and I've seen more and more concessions in the power sector, mini concessions, which were highly successful because consumers prefer to get connected to a service rather than and are ready to pay for that service if they are only allowed to pay for that service, rather than get the trucks of water or get the alternative fuel, which is so much more expensive on this. So that, to me, is a revolution which is happening right now in Africa in particular, where the countries are much more pragmatic about attracting the private sector, where there is much less ideology around it, where you have a search for yields of pension funds, and where, on the other hand, you have consumers which are much more ready to pay for the services than they used to.
Maybe a question on China, because that seems always like the big investor in Africa. Secretary, what has your experience been with China as an investor, as a infrastructure financier? I remember talking to an official in Sri Lanka a few years ago who said, when it comes to road and stadiums, we turn to China. When it comes to health, we turn to the World Bank. But you seem to suggest that you are still trying to push for more financing from the World Bank. If you can share what's been your good and bad points in working with China, and maybe Amadou, then if you want to give us a broader perspective on China, and also I see that Eric has an opinion as well.
Yeah, I just want to say that I think China has filled a huge gap that because obviously, as I said, development financial institutions will not be able to fill that. Our experience working in China has been really, I would say, very successful. Some of the critical infrastructure that we would have really wanted to do, we could get financing from PFIs. And a case in point is railway. We discussed railway for a long time in Kenya. We didn't see any interest from the DFI at all. The World Bank didn't want to touch it. The African Development Bank, natural donors, private sector, of course, would like it. You know, it's a huge project. It needs sort of government also to be involved. But when this was taken up by China, we've seen all what we just needed is to structure it in a manner that it attracted the Exim Bank, because also the Exim Bank of China is now operating like any other commercial bank, really. What they require is typically what other banks require. What they have taken much the risk to come in, and now as they have come, we've seen even other investors like General Electric wanting also to participate, to work with China, particularly in the locomotive area. So it has played a sort of a catalyst role to bring in other investors who would have obviously shined. I think we've seen, and also in the road sector, there are some particular roads in Kenya. For a long time, it was difficult to attract. For example, the Thika Road, which is now 3 or 4 lane, funded through together with African Development Bank. But it has really made a big difference in the lives of Nairobians. Before, it used to be a huge jam and all that. But our experience is that when they came in, other donors actually came in, like that, for example, African Development, and others also came in to participate.
And were there lots of strings attached on the China side? Did you have to in exchange?
Typically, it is sort of operates like a buyer's, credit, whereby, because it is their loan, usually the project is undertaken by a Chinese contractor. And that is even the norm now, what we see. A lot of other countries are also taking the same approach, where you provide the financing, but you also tie it with the support of exporting the service through using the contractor from that country. So that is how it essentially started from China. But we've seen, we've had also other projects now similarly structured the same way, where it's a sort of funded by an export credit facility. And in this case, it's just viewed as an export from China point of view.
Was there anyone on the panel before I open it to the floor? Anyone wanted to?
I was just going to make the point about China and the fact that one of the key benefits of China is actually the way that it is affected the geopolitical approach towards Africa. And I think from that point of view, the whole Chinese interest is not just been money, but it's also been profile, and the concerns about there's been a whole series of initiatives coming from not the Chinese, I'll put it like that, looking at potential Africa, which is, I think, extremely supportive towards African projects, but will also be supportive in terms of developing, and I'm not saying Kenya, but there have been a number of reported incidents of problems with environmental and social governance right the way through Chinese investor projects, some of the quality issues. But the fact that everybody is now keener to look at Africa because of some of these geopolitical issues, I think has been one of the, as you said, the catalyst of
side effect
in many ways.
Yeah, go ahead. Okay.
And so I think this is exactly one of the points I want to make, is that I think China has really shaken up this space. And you know, you talk about all these initiatives, you know, many of them are, I think, triggered, by responses to what the Chinese have done. So I think that has been a very important role and as you said, brought much more attention to Africa. And I think a lot of players are rethinking how they're doing things in light of what the Chinese have done. So the Chinese have had some issues, as you've probably seen, they've tried to do things inside the European Union. They have been, I think, surprised, and maybe you can understand why it's sort of surprising some of the way we deal with environmental challenges and so on. So I think there still is a lot of learning on the Chinese side as well. And I think there still are issues about transparency. I was just yesterday actually at the presentation when the paper looking at investments in Chinese projects in Africa, and they find two things. One is that unlike some of the sort of popular perceptions, Chinese investments are actually not very resource driven. So there's no, what they have done, what they had geocoded Chinese projects in Africa, and there's almost no correlation with resources. So it's not driven by resources, it's a much broader range of investments. There was one thing that stood out though, that the birthplace of and African leaders in different countries was significantly correlated to this investment. It's not a major thing, but they're saying there are still some issues maybe of governance and sort of the approach to how you allocate the capital that still has to be addressed.
Yeah. So I mean, just coming back, you know, I don't mean to say that the private sector has no role or has a negative role. And actually that's where the space is. If you look at 10% of the total financing, there's a lot of room to grow, especially when you see the constraints that the other financiers are facing. And also Africa is changing. There's a lot of interesting things, like my hometown, Dakar, has just issued the first municipal bond that is not guaranteed by the government, thanks to technical assistance from USAID and the Gates Foundation. So that's very encouraging. But my point is that so far, is the world delivering? We have a lot of announcement, a lot of project facilities, but where's the money? So it's taking time, and while it's taking time, let's not forget that we have to work to do for our fiscal revenues. Let's not forget that we have work to do in some countries for the pension and insurance reform. Let's not forget, basically that's my point. And when it comes to China, When we talk to many investors and the China, one of the comparative advantage that we hear the most is its speed. That by the time the World Bank or others do their studies and the assessment, the impact, you know, the Chinese are full steam going ahead and so on. And from a political economy, that's very, very attractive, you know, especially with the election cycles and so on. So, but also we've looked at where does a Chinese investment go in Africa, but we look at not just infrastructure, but the foreign direct investment. And it's a less concentrated than US and EU. It goes all over. It goes to all sorts of countries, from Zimbabwe to Angola, and it goes to all sectors, from opening a manufacturing plant in Ethiopia all the way to a railway. So it's very diffuse. Of course, if you compute now a governance, if you take that investment and you look at the governance weight of that, China looks better. Because it's all over, it's you know. So I'll just stop there.
I'm going to frustrate Michelle, who had a point, but I'd like to give you the opportunity to ask questions, and I see there are lots of hands raised. Maybe the sir in the back.
Thank you very much. Lawrence Freeman from the Africa Desk of Executive Intelligence Review. I've been involved in development in Africa for the last quarter of a century. There's nothing more important for Africa than infrastructure. And we see this even today with the spread of Ebola. The spread itself is a factor of the lack of infrastructure in West African countries, in basic infrastructure. And I think this is also crucial for the future of Africa, which is going to have 100 million youth very quickly. And if they don't have energy, water, and food, Africa is going to be in very difficult shape. I don't think this can be left to the marketplace or to the private sector. National governments, public credit, we pioneered it in this country with Alexander Hamilton and Washington through Roosevelt through Kennedy. Public credit. And this is what El Sisi is doing in Egypt today. They have funded the new Suez Canal through their own people, $8 billion. They're building agricultural and nuclear energy projects. And I think even though the new development bank of the BRICS is not in place yet, it's already changed the geometry of the world, because there is the Asian Investment Infrastructure Bank and national banks in China, India, and Russia. Russia is going to finance 9,600 megawatts of nuclear power in South Africa. So my question to the representative from the National Bank or National Secretary of Treasury in Kenya, how much are you oriented to this new geometry that's developing around government infrastructure, which these banks are doing and governments are doing, away from the West, which is shrinking and doesn't do infrastructure, and their own financial troubles are going to overtake them very quickly. And I wanted to get your approach to that.
Yeah. I fully agree with you. Even in Kenya, for example, we funded our own, a lot of our own infrastructure with our own resources. I mentioned earlier on the infrastructure bonds that we have issued in the domestic market because of our deep domestic financial markets. And of course, there is a limit to that. We have also, just even before that, the one, for example, the railway, we have actually dedicated a fund and by creating a railway development levy, which is our own resources. Currently, even now, before we receive the money flowing from China, we have already started the work using our own resources. So, it is very important for us actually to take the lead as a country. And we have done that by dedicating funds. We have seen where we have raised our resources. And, for example, the LAPSET project. The LAPSET is another corridor we are opening through Lamu and connecting Southern Sudan and Ethiopia. We are putting our own resources to create the first three BATs, and then draw in the private sector to come in to fund. But without doing that, you'll not even open up the pot even for any investor to think of of coming in. So government playing the role of first coming in, and then allowing the other private sector to. So it's very important, but there is a limit to that. Our tax revenues are not sufficient to cover that. Our market, if we borrow heavily, will also, crowd out the private sector also domestically. And we have also gone ahead to tap the international capital markets by way of issuing a sovereign bond. This is also completely debt from we are taking from the international community. And use the same money to actually invest in those infrastructure projects and then structure it in a manner that we can blend. I think the key thing now is really to blend resources in a manner that you can actually attract so many funders into one project. Because it's a very huge project, very expensive, where government can pay a little bit. You can also draw in equity. You can draw in debt from banks and all that. So a whole blending of resources is very, very important.
You had a point?
No, just a very quick addition to that. I mean, I think there's a bit of a sort of stigma when we talk about private sector and private sector doing this and private sector doing that. It is the case when we are investing really around the world that the majority of investments are made on a public-private partnership basis. And it is that partnership which is additional and over and above what we can do either in the public sector or the private sector alone. And it's actually getting the strength of the two parties together, which is going to be really most efficient in terms of creating and delivering infrastructure. And we see that the whole time. Because when you're talking about the private, who are you talking about? What we do is we actually are mobilizing the savings of millions of individuals. It's not as though it's a sort of magic pot in the sky that's completely divorced from public sector and people paying taxes. So I would talk about partnership as being the way forward rather than, and that's actually very, in this country, I think it's becoming increasingly active, the whole partnership concept in delivering infrastructure. That, I think, is the way forward rather than looking at it as being...
We shouldn't forget either that, the projects that were mentioned and particularly the whole fundamental infrastructure in this country was actually to a large extent funded by foreign creditors who that actually were then defaulted upon several times, but in any case.
Can we take another question? Over there.
Thanks. My name is Clay Lowry from Rock Creek Global Advisors. Great panel. I think this is a question for Julia. But others may want to weigh in. I keep hearing about a disconnect, which is, on one hand, the IMF, the World Bank, all the different development banks are saying we got to have more infrastructure. And on the other hand, the same group of people are basically saying we must crack down on banks and through Basel capital standards or insurance companies or pension funds through their asset managers. Is there and maybe this is just the private sector talking its book, but is there a disconnect that we're actually harming the funding or the financing of infrastructure by cracking down on those that actually are some of the suppliers of that funding?
I couldn't agree with you. I mean, I would talk with particular reference to in Europe, the European Commission, where one silo of activity has been about greater regulation. The other silo of activity has been promoting infrastructure in order to stimulate economies. And you look at these two organizations, think, do these people ever talk to one another? And I think that one of the actions the actual private sector is taking, and in fact, we've been engaged in setting up something called the Long-Term Infrastructure Investors Association, which is actually looking at addressing those very points in order to get over some of these huge hurdles that are in place, and the hurdles are largely because of lack of communication.
Well, I would say that I view it slightly differently. I think we will have to get used to the fact that banks will not be able to do what they did in the past. It's just the reality, and then we have to try to work around that. And what Meridiam is doing is, I think, highly complementary to that effort. So I think it's of course, there are examples where they don't talk to each other, but I think we just have to get used to the that there's a different reality out there, that the banks are not going to be doing what they did in the past. And we would have to look at what can capital markets do, you know, what can one, you know, what other innovative ways are there for getting money for infrastructure. And that's, for example, the reason why we're looking at this equity partnership is to bring in these long-term investors that have the same kind of tenor and that infrastructure projects need to have. And I think that's, more of a solution than trying to fight this financial regulation.
We're not trying to fight financial regulation. I have to say, I don't believe that we believe there is any exit that goes to the past. But what we're trying to do is to just bring together the differing thoughts so that we can actually move forward, as opposed to being stuck in this.
Just very quickly, one interesting trend also is what sovereign wealth funds are doing in many countries, like in the Middle East, for example, and how sovereign funds are thinking of investing domestically for their own infrastructure, which has pros and cons. But Norway will not do it, but some Middle Eastern sovereign wealth funds will do it.
Let's take a couple of questions together. So since we have about 10 minutes left, let's take three or what we have. I see a sir here in the middle, and then in the back.
Hi, my name is Rick Rybeck with Just Economics. I want to thank Brookings and the panel. Very informative, very helpful. I learned a lot today. I wanted to piggyback on comments by a number of panelists about the issue of the real problem being more related to funding than financing. If an infrastructure project doesn't generate revenue that will pay back the loans, it's hard to come up with a way of making those loans. And when I am anxious to look at innovative ideas, a lot of times I look back into history. And in Washington, D.C. in the 1890s, our streets here were mostly unpaved. So they were very dusty when it was dry, and when it was wet, travel was very difficult and very unpleasant. So paving the streets would have been very beneficial for everybody. And Congress decided to do that. And they could have taxed everybody to pay for the infrastructure, but they didn't. They decided that 50% of the cost of paving the streets should be paid by landowners whose property fronted a paved street. Now, a landowner might live in Philadelphia or New York, might never walk or ride on the street that was being paved, but that street, by paving it, was going to create a financial benefit for that landowner, because no longer would people be tracking dust, mud, and manure into their residential or business location, and thus the value of their property went up dramatically. So there are a number of places around the world, this technique is now generally referred to as value capture. There are places like Hong Kong, Singapore, Japan, Taiwan, to name a few, that have employed value capture techniques, and after doing so have seen their economies become very productive. And I'm just wondering if the panel is familiar with the value capture concept and what they think about that as a way forward.
You can decide who wants to take it. Who had a question? We can. We haven't had a lady yet.
Good morning. I'm Barbara Simmons. I'm Dean of International Education at William V.S. Tubman University in Liberia. Before I get to my question, there is a dormitory that was built for one of the universities in Liberia by the Chinese that the students are refusing to utilize because they built it with all of the toilets outside. So not everything that gets built by the Chinese is acceptable. My question is to Mr. Wormser. You said that there were four points that needed to be met in order to help private sector get involved. Is that the role, do you see it as just the role of the World Bank, or whose role is it to get those things done?
And I think we had a sort of question, sir, over there.
Yeah, hi, Creighton Jones with 21st Century Science and Technology. I just had a question regarding also China's role in Africa. At the last World Economic Forum in Africa, Premier Li said that they had the intention to connect all of the capitals of Africa with high-speed rail, and they wanted to build 80,000 kilometers of high-speed rail by 2020. So this really seems to be breaking the neo-colonial paradigm which had dominated Africa, of using different gauge rail for resource extraction, not allowing for, you know, countries to link up through rail. So do you think the fact that we're seeing the end of potentially the neo-colonial system in Africa, does that change, do you think, the way that private investment is going to view Africa as no longer a place for the looting of resources, but now have to think in terms of long-term real physical investment?
Yeah. So maybe who wants to? Who's familiar with the value capture?
I mean, I can.
No, go ahead.
Value capture has always been a wonderful solution because fantastic, all the buildings are going up, everybody's connected. And you mentioned various places. I can also mention Crossrail in the UK, where the rates have been increased for the earlier payment of going. And I think it is great as long as you have the value, yeah. Because the one area, and you know, in a number of them are, you know, we've obviously seen growth and we've seen development and the rest of it. If there was an issue, for example, in I can think of a country like Spain that has really suffered in the great financial crisis, and you know, the value there has been ripped out of a lot of property developments and of a lot of transport links. And if those ratepayers were having to pay higher rates as they saw the rates of their properties decrease, then I think there's an underlying issue. So as part of an overarching financing, I think it has a very strong place. In and of itself, as a sole solution, I think there could be certain issues.
Michel, there was a question directed at you.
No, it's not about the World Bank alone. I was taking the examples of the World Bank where I come from. But I would think that when you look at the four elements that I talked about, the sector reforms where the governments are going to be the ones driving the agenda, when you look at transformational projects where multilaterals, development agencies, but also regional agencies can have regional agencies can have a major role in pushing some of these big projects. When you look at risk mitigation, obviously there are a number of players. If you look at the political risk insurance market, it has increased by 10% a year over the last 7 years, which shows that there is both an appetite to go to some distant market, but also much more awareness of the political risk and need to mitigate those. And when you look at the balance sheet, I was not talking only about the World Bank, I was talking about anyone who has a balance sheet. But I would also add one point, which I think is behind your question, and also another question which was raised earlier, which is the need for these partnerships. The need for much more cohesion between what the BRICS are doing, what the World Bank is doing, what the regional organizations are doing. And here, China in particular, I have seen its role maturing quite a lot over the last 3 years, quite different from what it used to be 10 years ago, or five to 10 years ago. I can see both the countries become much more demanding in terms of what they want of the relation with China, and also wanting that relation to China to be much more integrated with what the others are doing. And I can see also China wanting to think of itself not as a cowboy into Africa, but much more as a partner of some of the others to get impact, and much more sensitive about the criticism that it has had so far on both the environmental issues and the labor issues. So I'm just saying that the China is in some ways a reflection of how this agenda should be moved, because it should not be moved by agencies or countries on their own, but much more as a global partnership in an agenda which is going to make the biggest difference, for example, in Africa.
Did anyone want to take the neo-colonialism or end of it question? I guess there was a private sector dimension.
Well, and here I think is where infrastructure links into, you know, many other aspects of development. And so I think the key to getting infrastructure going, and think of it as you know, municipal infrastructure, health, water, and sewage, and so on. What I think is key there is to get the consumers, end users involved in shaping these infrastructure investments. What you described was that this was pretty much determined by the resource extraction and those who control that were typically, you know, living outside the country. And you know, today also, it's not, the problem is not to finance that kind of infrastructure. I think that mostly is possible. But the real challenge is to get infrastructure in place that really meets the needs of people. And I think that's where, you know, the real challenge is to how do you build this structure? How do you get a willingness to pay? Because that also has to be part of sustainability of the kind of services that these local infrastructure offer. So, and involving these end users in the running and shaping of these infrastructure facilities over time. So I think that's where the real development challenge is. And that's, I think, is, you know, quite different from the neo-colonial approach. And so it's really about working with local local population, the local political structures, and trying to get people to get a sense that they are actually benefiting from these and are willing to pay. I think that's what the key challenge is.
I would agree with Eric, and actually last time we stumbled across a paper that came with this term, the governance of infrastructure, saying that governance is a catch-all phrase, but we should think about what governance really means when it comes to infrastructure, and included elements like, you know, what is the role of the end users and of society, civil society. Yes.
Thank you. I think we've run out of time for this panel, so I wanted to thank all of our panelists for their very good insights, and thank you all for coming.